Good afternoon, everybody. This is Jeff J. Brown, China Writers Radio, Sinoland founder of Seek Truth Faction Foundation and this China Writers Group. And I am so excited to have on the show today, Richard C. Cook. How are you doing, Richard?
Very well, thank you.
Richard and I have been struggling to get together. We both had some complications, but I'm really excited to have him on. He has got a heck of a resume. Let me read you his quick bio. Richard C. Cook is a co-founder and lead investigator for the American Geopolitical Institute. Mr. Cook is a retired U.S. federal analyst with extensive experience across various government agencies, including the U.S. Civil Service Commission, the FDA, the Carter White House, NASA, and the U.S. Treasury. I bet he's got some stories he could tell us. As a whistleblower at the time of the Challenger disaster, he exposed the flawed O-ring joints that destroyed the shuttle, documenting the event in his book, Challenger Revealed. I will have all of his book links places where you can follow his writing on the webpage. After serving at Treasury, he became a vocal critic of the private financial controlled monetary system, detailed his analysis in We Hold These Truths, the hope of Monetary Reform. He served as an advisor to the American Monetary Institute and worked with Congressman Dennis Kucinich to advocate for replacing the Federal Reserve with a genuine national currency. See his new book, Giving a Revisionist View of U.S. History, Our Country, Then and Now, with the Clarity Press, wonderful publishing house. And before we get started, Richard, can you tell us where you are? I know you have your Substack, but you're also writing regularly. Who are you writing regularly with? Is it Veterans Today or?
No, yeah, it's Veterans Today, which today is called VT Foreign Policy.
Okay, all right. Well,
the American Geopolitical Institute was co-founded by them, and so we have our own separate page and archive.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I do have a new Substack. It's called Three Sages.
Yeah, I'm getting it. I'm subscribed.
Yeah, two other gentlemen, roughly my generation. Fadi Lama, who writes from Lebanon.
Oh, wow.
He's our West Asian contact. And Dr. Lewis Coleman, who is a medical doctor who writes on medical issues, including the COVID pandemic.
Yeah, thank you for the L in pandemic. I totally agree. Thank you very, very much. Can I ask how old you are, Richard?
I'm sorry?
Can I ask how old you are?
I'm 77.
77. All right. Well, I'm 70, so I'm coming right behind you. Well, listen, Richard has this wonderful new book, and he is going to walk us through it. This is his show. This is a masterclass in revisionist history. For me, revisionist history is true history. I'll stop him every once in a while to ask a question, but otherwise, it's his show, and I want him to enthrall us with how we got into the mess we are in today, especially in the West. Take it away, Richard.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. It's great to be with you here today. My book is An American History. It's something I've been studying really my whole life. My mother was a tour guide for Colonial Williamsburg. Hmm. And we lived a mile from the Williamsburg historic area. And so I was brought up on American history.
Wow.
Then I went to William & Mary, which was Thomas Jefferson's alma mater. And then I came to work for the U.S. government in Washington, D.C., and spent the better part of 32 years working for diverse agencies, civilian agencies. And I took a couple of years to teach history at the secondary level. So, yeah, I'm a historian. My Challenger book was very well received. And then when I wrote the monetary book, that was really my starting point on trying to explain monetary history as I learned about it working for the U.S. Treasury Department for 20 years. It's a fascinating story. And it's essentially, Jeff, the story of how the United States lost its sovereignty. And its sovereignty remains lost until this day. And no matter what any politician will tell you about all the great things they're going to do, they're not in charge. So we have to always keep that in the back of our mind. Now, my first European ancestor came to America in 1638.
Wow.
He landed in Massachusetts. He was a Puritan blacksmith. His father, who was a minister, was dragged through the streets of London behind a horse by the authorities of King Charles I and Archbishop Laud of the Church of England. And so we are dissenters from a long, long time ago. They came here for religious freedom, not just for religious freedom. They came here out of fear of their lives. They were told that if they didn't get out, they would be killed. And in fact, his brother died in the king's prison, and his father died of the injuries he received. So my ancestors have been involved with this experiment called America for a long, long time. Now, you put side by side, of course, we're all a blend. And it so happened that my mother's family married into the French-Canadian lineage. Mm. And there we have Native American ancestry. So we've got the Puritans and the Native Americans and lots of stuff in between. And so what I wanted to do was tell the story of America from the point of view of the people who were there, the people who lived and suffered and gained freedom a long time ago, and show how that freedom was gradually lost as it has been today. And so I interweave the history of America with all kinds of family reminiscences and family communication. I've got a great grandfather who rode in the Oklahoma Land Rush. My mother grew up near the Indian reservations in Montana. I was born in Montana, near the Flathead Reservation. And so I've got a whole history of the Flathead tribes interwoven. So you'll see all of these different storylines jumping in and out. But the focal point is really monetary and financial history. Because if you go back to the early 1600s, America, or what became the United States, survived, got settled, had a lot of conflict with the Indians, but also a lot of relationships with the Indians, and did it all for 2 centuries without a single bank. There was no bank in America until 1781, during the Revolution, when the Bank of North America was created. And that's where the travesty that today we call fractional reserve banking and the rule of usury came into the United States and gradually took over. And that's where we are today, because that takeover determined the entire future history of America and the Western world. And of course, as you know, with your extensive background in other parts of the world, the Western powers, driven by these financial imperatives, took over, colonized, subverted all the rest of the world as well.
Yeah.
And now we're facing today the conflict as the rest of the world wakes up to that and has said they're going to chart their own course. Now, let me give you, if that's okay, I want to give you a piece of background.
All right.
As to what we're talking about when we discuss the monetary system. And the paper that you got, that I sent to you, subsequently became an article that I published called U.S. Collapse Triggers End of 500-Year Financier Conspiracy. Okay, so that's kind of the centerpiece. But you have to go back in history, and this is what I wrote in the article. European expansion, which, as we know, began around the year 1500, required a monetary system to enable its growth. Because when Columbus built the three ships, he needed the capital to finance that enterprise. Now, during the Middle Ages in Europe, the group called the Knights Templar, and those of your listeners who are familiar with medieval history know that the Knights Templar were the centerpiece of the European monetary system, but they did not charge interest for lending. Charging interest from lending is called usury, where you got to pay back more than you borrowed. And of course, you realize that if everybody took loans and had to pay back more than they borrowed, the whole society would run out of money very quickly. It would go broke. And that's exactly what has happened to us and continues to happen today. Every single society and economic system under the rule of Western financial power gradually goes broke or bankrupt. And the money lenders gradually take over the enterprise. And that's where we are today. But anyway, the Catholic Church had prohibited usury. It was considered a mortal sin. And that continued for 1,000 years. And of course, Islam today still has that prohibition. But the Catholic Church abandoned that position around the year 1500. And that coincides precisely with the period of European expansion, where the bankers began to lend more and more and more to everybody, to merchants, to kings, parliaments, everything, and gradually take in the profits through usury. And once they began to ship back gold and silver, both from America and soon afterwards from India, particularly, and China, and they built their financial system on this by always lending more than the gold and silver they had in reserve. And that was the system. And what it did was it assured that usury-based banking created the accumulation of wealth by the owners of the merchant banks that rules the world today. They are the sovereigns. They are the power that rules governments, that rules, that decides on war and peace, that enslaves populations, and that today, as I state in my book, is engaged in genocide against the world's population, including against the populations of the Western states.
Yeah, thank you. That's true.
Now, I do point on out, but I don't really make a big, big deal out of it. Many of the bankers who were involved in this transition were Jewish. I mean, we all know that. We all know who the Rothschilds are. But they weren't the only ones. And it was really the Christian center, the papacy, and the powers behind the Christian organized religion that opened the floodgates to this by relaxing their prohibition against usury. They're the ones who need to be called to account for this. Okay, so that's kind of the background. And then I go in the article and in what I sent to you, all of the different catastrophes that flow out of this system. And you want me to read my list? I mean, it's a
Before we get started, who the first bank you said was in 1781 in Philadelphia? Who financed that bank?
Well, that's the interesting question. It was set up by the people who ran the Continental Congress at that time. You know, the leaders of the what was becoming the United States. And then that morphed into the First Bank of the United States after the Constitution was written. And Alexander Hamilton was the Secretary of Treasury who put in place the First Bank of the United States. Who financed it? That's the key question. It was financed by the purchase of stock by European bankers primarily.
Wow.
And these European bankers were Dutch, because Holland was a big player back then in banking. That's where the Bank of England came from, really. It came when William and Mary took over England in 1688, and they set up the Bank of England out of the Amsterdam banks. But it was the bankers in London, bankers in Holland. There were also, at various times, bankers in France and Germany involved. But the focal point was always, at that time, London and Holland. And as Holland faded away, it became London. And of course, as we know, in the 19th century, it became principally the Rothschilds. There were also American bankers being set up who were involved in that. The big banking center at the time was Philadelphia, because that's where the first bank was set up, and also New York. And New York was beginning to set up its own merchant banks based on the principle of usury at this time. So the bankers were the people with the money. And a lot of the money that was capitalized in these early banks came from opium dealing in China, came from the slave trade out of Africa, which both US and Britain abolished, and various forms of speculation and in land, particularly the land that was taken away from the Indians. This land was capitalized and became part of what these banks were trading in. But the thing about the opium trade with China was China paid in gold for the opium. And so, and as you know, opium wars were fought to keep the ports in China open for Britain and the United States to sell opium to them in exchange for gold. Later, India became a big gold supplier. And so the wealth of Britain and the United States was built at least in significant part on the opium trade with the Orient,
mm-hmm.
from India and from China. And you said I had stories to tell. And my book tells this story. It tells the story of the use of Chinese gold to finance growth in the United States through opium trade. So anyway, that's just one of the devastating flaws in the financial system.
Well, please go through your list because it's fascinating.
Okay, well, I'll try to do this fairly quickly. One is massive public and private debt. Two, centralization of wealth, because it's the bankers who are sucking in the money in the producing economy. So in order to pay this, you have to have constantly increasing economic growth. And that leads to consolidation, monopoly of big businesses. And as you look at the United States industrial revolution, it was increasingly built upon monopolies that were put together by the bankers, particularly the banker named J.P. Morgan. You had to have money spent faster and faster because what money was in circulation wasn't enough. So it had to constantly be used in exchange. And so that created huge growth of cities, because if you pack people into cities, they're going to spend that money faster before it's called back into the bank through payment of debt. That's called velocity of spending. And if you listen to our fantastic politicians, you realize I'm talking about terms, concepts they know absolutely nothing about. I mean, ask Joe Biden what he thinks of velocity of money. And see what kind of an answer that you get. So the tendency, of course, is to inflate the currency. Because if you're having to pay off debt, you're going to inflate your prices. And that's what you see in the housing markets. Constant inflation, because you got to inflate the currency and the prices of houses. Because when you buy a house, you know you're going to sell it in a few years. So you try to sell it for more to pay your mortgage, to pay your debts. And looming behind you is the constant threat of bankruptcy. And we do have a bankruptcy safety valve. And the purpose of that is people can't pay their debts, so you got to have a way out. But you can't charge off your taxes on bankruptcy. You can't charge off alimony. You can't charge off student loan debt. So it's pretty restricted, even that safety valve. But everything that a human being does today is associated with some kind of financial profit. There's this great Bing Crosby movie. It's a Christmas movie.
Oh, yeah. I know the one you're talking about.
Everybody's got an angle.
Yeah.
He's very upset, but he's right. Everybody's got an angle to make more and more money because they are constantly running only a little bit ahead of our debt. Then along with that, you got to cut costs. How do you cut costs? Well, you can reduce the pay for your employees. You can do what they're doing now with leveraged buyouts or with stock buybacks. You can lay them all off, or you can move the factory to China or to Bangladesh or to Mexico and cut your costs that way. But it's a constant imperative. And as we can see, it also is a huge incentive to crime. Cutting corners, white collar crime. And then the big one in today's economy is sale of drugs. And sale of drugs, as you know from your comments on the Chiang Kai-shek phenomenon, has been a backbone of Western intelligence. And of course, they feed all of those profits through money laundering into the banking system.
Mm-hmm.
Another one. Then you got political crime, constant propaganda and cover-ups to hide all of this, because it all has to be swept under the rug. And then finally, you have unending competition and warfare among the nation states. Because just like every individual is trying to keep one step ahead of their debt, every nation is trying to keep one step ahead of their debt. In the United States, with sovereign debt now of $34 trillion and interest payments on that approaching $1 trillion a year, the imperative to make war and to rob and steal from other nations is enormous. And we can see that so clearly.
Mm-hmm.
The Ukraine war, the Gaza war, where they're trying to get hold of resources off the shores of Gaza so the Palestinians don't get it, and the war against Iraq, the hope for a war against Iran, it all has to do with getting resources to pay down the debt. And so, Jeff, we could talk for 100 years about this and not basic picture.
Yeah, Syria, they're obviously, the U.S. military is illegally occupying Syria and stealing their oil and wheat.
Right. Yeah.
Wheat. Just blatant theft.
Yeah.
It's unreal.
So anyway, I write about all that. And it takes up 400 and some pages.
Well, I want to ask you a few questions about, well, first off, you mentioned bankruptcy. Unfortunately, my wife and I, we got sucked into the real estate house of cards in 2008 and went bankrupt. So we know all about bankruptcy.
Right.
One thing you mentioned, you said, you know, that the politicians don't control anything. It made me think about, I've got the letter somewhere, but Franklin Delano Roosevelt actually wrote a letter, a private letter to one of his friends or members of his government, basically saying that he couldn't pass gas without contacting the bankers first. You know, everything in the New Deal had to be signed off on by the banks, so that. Even a savvy, powerful president like FDR, you know, an amazing politician, he felt he was under the thumb of the big banks. So if he had to get permission, then we can know that everybody since him has had to get permission, and those that didn't, like Kennedy, got killed.
Correct.
So So he got killed.
And here, can I say something else? Something about Roosevelt?
Yeah.
Well, when the New Deal began, the economy crashed, and I write this in my book because the Bank of England finagled the Federal Reserve into shipping the gold reserve that England had lost to America owing to World War I back to Europe. That's what crashed the economy for the Great Depression. So Roosevelt came in, and he and his brain trust did have a lot of plans, but the American bankers were very much opposed to him, except for one. That's when the Roosevelt family decided, we think we're going to support this guy, and we're going to back the New Deal, because what it's going to lead to is massive government borrowing. And the bank has always been in favor of government borrowing, not just because of the obvious benefits, but because they manage the sales of government debt to the public. And so that's when the Rockefellers took over the U.S. economy. It was during the New Deal, based on their decision to support Roosevelt in his program
of government
borrowing. And they stayed in control of the U.S. government all the way, through the life of David Rockefeller and on into today through institutions like the Rockefeller Foundation. So, Roosevelt had to buy into this and set the stage for what followed.
Even though there was an attempted fascist coup against him by American industrialists, including George Herbert Walker Bush's father.
Yeah, Prescott Bush was was also caught selling lots of stuff to Hitler.
There was a real bromance between American industrialists and Hitler.
And not just American, but British as well.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you, I'm just going through your notes here. You said that because I was taught when I went to catechism, at church as a kid, I was always told that Pontius Pilate killed Jesus Christ. But now I'm hearing from more and more people that it wasn't Pontius Pilate, but that it was actually the Jewish bankers in the temples that killed him. But so can you clarify that?
This has always been of great interest to me. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe somebody else will, but when Jesus came to Jerusalem for the final Passover, the first thing he did, or at least one of the first, was he went to the temple and he threw out money changers.
Dumped over their tables and turned over their tables.
There's nothing else in the New Testament like this. And I've been, my wife and I go to church, and I can't tell you how hard it's been for the minister to try to explain that away. Why he didn't really mean it. But to my mind, that was the central beef that the Jewish elders, priests, scribes, establishment had against Jesus. I mean, he could talk all he wanted, and they would, pick up rocks to throw at him, but he'd always slipped away, it says. But that was the one thing they could not tolerate, was his assault on the merger of the financial system with the religious institutions. And if you look at the temple is a very symbolic thing. You can look at the temple as the entire structure of human existence.
We live
in the temple.
A metaphor.
And here's Jesus throwing the money changers out of human life. He knew, and there was a long background, and I write about this in my book too, of usury being condemned in the ancient world. And here were the Jewish elders in Jerusalem building their power essentially on usury. And Jesus came in to put a stop to that. And so, that's kind of how I interpret it.
But why was I told that Pontius Pilate killed him? The Roman governor of Palestine. Why was I told that?
Well,
to not say that it was the Jews that killed him?
Yeah. Yeah.
To white. It was those dirty Roman. It was those dirty Roman pagans that. Right. That killed Jesus.
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking forward to reading your book because I just, could you say you have family anecdotes in your book? I just interviewed, I'm not going to get up and pick it up, but I just interviewed Thomas Powell a couple of months ago. He's a co-founder of the Bioweapons Truth Commission with myself and a couple of other people, and he wrote a book called The Secret Ugly about the U.S. use of bioweapons during the Korean War. Yeah. And his father, of course, was persecuted. His father was persecuted by the U.S. government because he was in China exposing the truth of all of this. Yeah. Of all of this bioweapon use. And in fact, it wasn't until Robert F. Kennedy, the Attorney General for his brother JFK, finally called off the dogs in 1961, and then to quit trying to persecute his dad for exposing those secrets. But anyway, he has family anecdotes in his book, and he usually put them at either the beginning or the end of each chapter. And it was just brilliant. It really personalized the story and really made it more relatable.
Right.
So I'm sure you probably felt the same way when you added your anecdotes, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yep.
Yeah.
And if we have time, we have another couple of minutes.
Of course.
Right. There's two other points here that I think is very, very critical for people to hear and to work into their own picture of history. First of all, the term that I finally settled on to use to describe what Pepe Escobar brilliantly calls the hegemon, what I call the hegemon, I call the Anglo-American Zionist Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, with that background, I want to read one sentence here from my article. This takes us back to around 1900. British gold and diamond magnate Cecil Rhodes.
Oh yeah.
Had directed his executor, Lord Nathan Rothschild, to create a, quote, secret society, unquote, to, quote, recover America for the British Empire, unquote, which was done through a century of world wars, with Britain providing the brains and America the muscle. We are still in that era.
Yeah. What you mentioned, absolutely. You mentioned to me, and we were exchanging emails, you have a book that you like about World War One was basically a game plan just mapped out by the Brits and the French with collusion with the Russians until Lenin took over. In 1917. What is the name of that book that you like so much?
A really important book. It's by an Italian-American author from Italy who was educated at American universities. He now lives in Italy. His name is Guido Preparata. You can look them up on Amazon.
Well, I'll put the book link in and your interview on your interview webpage.
The title of the book is Conjuring Hitler: How Great Britain and America Created the Third Reich and Destroyed Europe.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Brilliant book. I think it's the best book I've ever read on that era. And you take the phrase destroyed Europe and you look at what Europe has become and what the European Union has become. And you know and see every day how they destroyed Europe.
Yeah, absolutely.
As a sovereign. The best commentator on this that I follow is Alex Cristoforo on the Duran.
Yeah, the Duran. Okay.
A brilliant commentator on what Europe has become.
I live here and vote here, so I can. It's a complete and total embarrassing circus. So I'm disgusted. You mentioned that the World War II never ended, but could we say it's almost like World War I never ended? I mean, it's just a continuum. It's the same. It's just a one timeline.
And I've often had that thought, and I may say that in the book. I think that's one of the themes of the book. The British Empire took over America through World War I, made it its enforcer, because England is pathetic when it comes to troops on the ground, but America had endless manpower.
And industry.
Yeah. But they were able to get Woodrow Wilson to send 1 million men to France in 1917 after he had promised
not to
keep us out of war.
Yeah.
Okay, so, but going, following up on that, something happened in World War II, and I'm going to read another paragraph if I could.
Sure, please.
Okay. So we had World War I, and now World War II is beginning in Europe. And Preparata's book explains how Britain particularly instigated the start of World War II. Meanwhile, in 1940 to 1941, the U.S. Council on Foreign Relations, a Rockefeller-controlled entity modeled on Britain's Chatham House, submitted a series of studies to the U.S. government that established a permanent policy of total U.S. military domination over the entire world. This policy, which was in writing, has been well documented. I didn't make this up. There's other places you can read in detail about it. This policy became the post-World War II national security state. It was the origin of the CIA, the NSA, etc. Later, it became the Wolfowitz Doctrine in 1991, where no other power would be allowed to arise that could compete with the United States. And finally, in the 2000s, under Bush and then Obama, the policy of full-spectrum dominance, which included cyberspace, outer space, etc. All of this was planned, and the planning began with the Council on Foreign Relations, which is the centerpiece of the U.S. Intelligence apparatus.
Yeah, absolutely. The I would like to get that book about World War II. Helped rip the scales off of my eyes was a book in its sequel about World War I called Hidden Histories, by Doherty and McGregor, a couple of Scottish researchers, and they took Carol Quigley's challenge to take his work and expand upon it, and it lays out World War I, the Brits again. It's like every time you turn, Napoleon, the Brits destroyed the French Revolution. they are just throughout history, the Brits at the City of London. You know, it's never ending. But everything about World War I, going back to Cecil Rhodes in 1891, and the, you know, setting up the secret society with Nathaniel Rothschilds and the Queen of England and Haldane, and they just mapped it out. I mean, they planned out World War One, just like a playbook, like a football playbook, you know, just play after play after play. Even the supposed assassination of the Archduke of that was all organized by the British. It was a false flag. And they hired gangsters to do that.
You could throw in the mix the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, because the Federal Reserve was created to facilitate the lending to Europe and Britain and France of the money to fight the war by the New York banks that had the capital to distribute. And that's how America became so rich. With the Roaring Twenties, they had that tremendous boom that the British then pulled the rug out from under that and crashed the system into the Great Depression.
Yeah, okay. So
it all fits together.
Yeah, the Brits are here, there, everywhere.
Yes.
You have another point. The Industrial Revolution took place after the Civil War with capital from U.S. and British banks led by the Morgans and the British Rothschilds. By 1900, the Money Trust controlled U.S. industry. With the Rothschilds and their banking allies, they created the Federal Reserve in 1913 to finance Britain's war to annihilate Germany. But where, in terms of the Industrial Revolution, where did the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the DuPonts, what would be today the billionaire families in America, where do they fit into this with the Industrial Revolution and the banking?
Well, they had the genius to master the technology, and the way John D. Rockefeller the First did that was that he consolidated the railroads and did vertical integration so that he controlled all the transport for oil. I mean, he was a genius. He was a genius of marketing, a genius of industrial organization, but he too had to borrow money from the Rothschild Bank in order to do all that. Same with Carnegie. Carnegie was a Flossman with tremendous mechanical intelligence. He was able to master the industrial processes for creating steel. He also had the benefit of the United States government allowing him to import large numbers of workers from Europe at virtual starvation wages.
Mm-hmm.
And when they rebelled against that, he had the ability to get the government to send in the troops to suppress the riots. And then when his business was up and running, he went, he relocated to Scotland, became a country gentleman, and essentially sold U.S. Steel to J.P. Morgan's banking process to create the Steel Trust. There were a lot of people who caught the wave of science and engineering, but were able to use the political and financial system to get a leg up. But by 1900, the banks had pretty much taken over control of all of the big industries and consolidated them into bank-controlled trusts. The railroad trust was one.
Mm-hmm.
The steel trust. And at the top of it all was the money trust. And that was run by two individuals, J.P. Morgan, who was the Rothschild representative in America, and John D. Rockefeller Jr., who was the heir to the Rockefeller fortune,
mm-hmm.
that was carried into the U.S. establishment. And so there were really two money trusts, and I write about this, by World War One, the Rockefellers and the Morgans. Gradually, the Rockefellers took over because they were smart enough to finance Roosevelt's New Deal. With Nelson Rockefeller and David Rockefeller being the government and the financial kingpins of modern times.
Hmm. Fascinating.
All in the book.
One thing I did want to point out to you, and I it's funny because you in your outline you talk about, let me see, where is it? You're talking about the U.S. elections And you mention Robert Kennedy ignores the larger economic issues with a campaign that well may be a, quote, limited hangout. It's funny that you wrote that, because I read his book, The Wuhan Cover-Up, about COVID, and I exposed it. I mean, I spent 2 or 3 weeks reading and researching his book, and it, and his book is a classic CIA limited hangout to blame the Chinese about COVID.
Right.
Whereas all the evidence in the book is that it was the United States that was the mastermind behind the COVID. Back into the 60s, the Fort Detrick was mutating coronaviruses in the 60s to try to develop a coronavirus weapon. So I just thought it was pretty, the limited hangout. For those of you who don't know, a limited hangout is when you're caught with your pants down in the public, you kind of sort of fess up to it, and then you overload the public with just mountains of information and mountains of news, and you get them so flummoxed and so overwhelmed with information that they just turn off. And that's why, you know, maybe even RFK's run, because I think he's clearly, you know, with his book, that's a CIA book, and his campaign manager is his daughter-in-law. That's right. It's his daughter-in-law, and she is a former CIA agent.
She
wrote a book about it.
His Kennedy's knowledge of economics is, I want to use the word pathetic, but I don't want to be too unkind. And I've written so many comments and messages to them. I wrote an article for him for his website. I've said, I'll come in, I'll brief him on economics. I won't charge you anything. They totally ignore it. Yeah. All he'll say is, well, we'll get a lower interest rate on housing for young people. So he doesn't go nearly as far as Trump or Biden, for that matter.
Yeah. Well, I guess as we close out our discussion here, how do we get rid of these bastards? I mean, as long as they're there, as long as the banking, the money cartel is there, the Western world has no hope. How do we get rid of the bastards?
Well, I started writing about this stuff in 2007. That's when I published my monetary.
Okay. Book. Okay.
And I started writing on the Global Research website, monetary articles. And there's a lot there that people have not really heard of. And I've said to my wife, that was, 18 years ago, 18 years ago? And I said to my wife, why am I doing this stuff? And she says, you know, and we talk about these things. She says, I think it's had an impact. You see people using this terminology now. A lot more people are becoming aware of what's going on and how the linchpin in all this is the financial system. Of course, the collapse in 2008, 2009 had a big part of it. I mean, that got a lot of attention of a lot of people. And people were saying, well, what is going on? And I try to explain all that again in my book. And the economy since then, I mean, you can't go a day without reading that the collapse is around the corner. So people are getting attuned to it. They're starting to wake up to this stuff. And I just hope that, if enough people start hitting on these few basic ideas, the U.S. lost its sovereignty in 1913 because of the Federal Reserve Act. And now Thomas Massie, the congressman from Kentucky, has introduced a bill with some support to abolish the Federal Reserve. Now, he doesn't know why. He doesn't know what to put in his place, but at least he's got a bill on record in Congress. So maybe some people are starting to think about it. It's a long, gradual process, and there's going to be a lot of pain between now and the millennium when enough people know what's going on to be able to put something in its place that really works. The public banking movement, for instance, is another thing that's really got going.
Ellen Brown, she's really good too.
Yeah, she's a good friend of mine, and Ellen and I have been talking to each other for the whole time, trading ideas and trading views. The Green Party has incorporated major monetary reform in its platform. And of course, the establishment is desperate to get rid of the Green Party and Jill Stein for a whole variety of reasons. But if you look at the platform, and I've worked with them on some of their programs, here's a body of people who really understands the system and what needs to change. So it's a gradual process, but it's an educational process. And anybody who's got an interest has simply got to pass on the available information, promote it, and gradually something has to change.
Mm-hmm. Because right now, globally and historically, the only countries that have been able to get rid of these bastards are communist socialist countries like China, and who kicked them out.
Correct.
Who kicked their butts out of Shanghai.
That's right. AIG was among those.
Yeah.
The group that was kicked out of Shanghai.
Yeah, absolutely.
And came and took over the U.S.
Yeah. Well, before we leave, what's your latest project? What is your next project? Are you working on something besides your ongoing journalism? Are you working on a new book?
No, I am not working on a new book. I'm working on the articles.
Okay.
I spend probably anywhere from 2 to 4 hours a day on the internet, commenting on other people's articles and substacks. I comment on Kucinich's. I comment on Kennedy's. And I always raise the same basic points. And I've gotten quite a positive response to doing that. So that's kind of my daily work. We also have a really nice garden. we are having green smoothies every day now.
One place you might want to look into, I mean, I know Robert Van Rocks and the China Metallic, his website's Metallic Man, and then Godfrey Roberts within the China Rose Group, they have very effectively used Quora. Mm-hmm. And you might want to look in there. They're constantly sending me questions about China, and I occasionally will answer one of them. But that's another one of those places you might be able to leave some comments and educate some people.
Yeah, good point.
So. Well, listen, Richard, this has been wonderful. It's hard to believe we've talked for almost an hour.
Right.
And I didn't know you were on global research all those years ago. So I'll ask you for all of your information. Before we go, I'd like to read a quote that you have at the end. And it is, every human enterprise must serve life, must seek to enrich existence on earth, lest man become enslaved where he seeks to establish his dominion. And this is by Bo-Yin Ra, who was Joseph Anton Schneider-Franken, born 1876, died 1943. Before we close out, can you tell me a little bit of something about him?
Yeah, he was a spiritual teacher. He was an artist by profession, and he traveled throughout Europe before World War I, particularly to Greece and to Italy. And in Greece and Italy, he met representatives of Eastern religions. And he became initiated in Eastern religions but he also rediscovered the spiritual genealogy of Western man. And he kind of merged these together. And he began publishing in Leipzig with the famous publisher Kurt Wolf, which probably a lot of your readers have heard of. And he published a series of 42 volumes.
Wow.
They're not real long, but the he had over in his maturity over a million readers in the German-speaking world. He eventually went to live and publish in Switzerland, and that's where he spent the latter years of his life as World War II started up. He lived in Switzerland. He became a very well-known figure in Germany, and his works began to be translated into English in the 1970s.
Oh, not until the 70s. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Now they're becoming more and more available. The Kober Press of Berkeley, California.
You can look I see that also. I see that. I'll check here. Oh, you actually have a hyperlink. So what I'll do is I'll also include that link in your interview webpage.
Yeah.
So sounds like a fascinating guy. Bo Yen Ra, a.k.a. Joseph Anton Schneider Franken. So thank you very much.
Yeah.
Well, Richard, I'm going to give you a Buddhist bow.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a wonderful show. You've been giving me an education, and I know you've given the fans out there an education. Let's stay in touch. And do it again. Do it again after you've written a few articles, and we can cover some different bases.
That's great.
All right.
Yeah,
thank you. Talk to you later, Richard. Bye bye. I'll send you the links so you can promote it when it's all done.
That's great. Thank you so
much. Bye bye. Bye bye.
See you.